Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, March 29th. I'm Ray Graff. You know, spring is finally here. They're playing baseball. The weather is warming up, and the gardeners are here. It is our first gardening program of the spring. We welcome back horticulturalist Bob Graves of Fadigan's Nursery, gardener Greg Ward of Ward's Nursery, and arborist Fred Breglia of Landis Arboretum. We welcome your gardening calls right now. 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You may also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Try to keep the Latin terminology to a minimum in the emails. I see one already. It's going to be trouble. 800-348-2551. We'll be back and start the show after the news. Hi, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's the gardening show, and we have our dream team here today. Fred Breglia is director of the Landis Arboretum in Esperance, New York. Bob Graves is co-owner of Fadigan's Nursery in Latham, New York. Greg Ward is the one of the head honchos. The head honcho, I would say?
One of.
At Ward's Nursery, a lawn and garden resource in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. Bob, Fred, Greg, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be back.
Yeah.
We brought spring with us.
Absolutely.
I love it. We welcome your calls now at 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. You can also email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number, 800-348-2551. You know, we were having a conversation before the show started here in Studio A, and Fred said, I love winter. And it was universally scorned by the rest of us. Are you happy it's over yet?
Well, you know, I'm not going to answer that question on the air, but I will say this. For the folks that really are hating the snow, it is really good for the plants.
Okay.
And it's really good for the trees, the shrubs, all the native stuff that you've planted.
Okay. But enough's enough, right?
Enough's enough. Yeah. I'll give you that.
We can all agree on that.
It's okay, yeah.
And it also is good to see that it doesn't just melt out instantly, even though people are probably hitting me on that one, too.
Doesn't mean we're not going to see some damage, because we had some weird weather in February. You know, we had 70 degrees.
Yeah.
We did.
And cold.
And it wasn't a lot of snow cover during that.
It wasn't a lot of snow cover then, so I'm seeing a lot of burn.
I wrote that down, because over in the Berkshires, I would say, so far, we're not seeing too much.
It's all often regional.
What are you seeing it on?
Dwarf Albertas, evergreens, you know, some rhodies.
I'm noticing
it on broadleaf evergreens, some your needled evergreens.
We saw some last minute deer browse, like severe deer browse, where plants that you would say, oh yeah, deer do like those, but they had been missing them for many years. They just had ignored them. Come in and within a few weeks, do some serious damage.
A lot of damage.
A lot of times you say it's deer resistant, and it will be deer resistant during a normal year, but when they get into starvation mode,
I don't think anything's deer proof.
You start to see them eat blue spruce, it's getting pretty bad.
In my yard, I have several things that I think they might eat, but they just don't bother. Maybe it's the neighborhood, there's not enough, you know, there's maybe someone else has a lot more somewhere. But those are the things that you have to go, you know, maybe this is the year I put up a little netting or something, because then this kind of thing happens.
Yeah,
exactly.
You never know.
And I'm also noticing a lot of girdling on a lot of young shrubbery,
rabbits.
Too.
Oh,
rabbits
gosh.
With
oh,
a lot
goodness.
Of the deep snow. They're able to, in voles even, because now they can travel.
And they eat it as the snow melts.
That's it. Right. So we're going to have our share.
Yep.
This email came in, and then we'll get right to the phones. This is from Matt in East Hampton. I have two small evergreen trees / large shrubs outside my house. They are across from each other on opposite sides of a sidewalk, maybe 15 feet apart. I believe one is Camassiparis piscifera Boulevard. You dirty rotten
image. Well done.
And I'm not sure what the other one is. My question is, one of the branches of the Camassiparis piscifera, it is as if someone has grafted a branch from the other tree. This has occurred naturally, not from anything I've done to it. What's going on here? Yeah. I love the show. And Matt, thank you very much for those words.
Yeah. So you know, we all sort of looked at that, I think, already, and we all have talked about this off air, and we all agree that it's probably just a sprout from the root system, which most plants are grafted.
Yeah.
So different plants stuck on top of another root system, and occasionally the little
So if you looked at that
sport or
where that branch was coming from. So this is a blue shrub, this boulevard cypress is much easier to say, right?
Well, why don't we just do that?
Yep, that's what we do.
We were just seeing if you could manage it.
You know what?
And you did well.
What annoys me to no end is that you guys all saw the email beforehand. Help me out, for Pete's sake.
And that the if it's grafted, so they took the blue boulevard selection that someone found, one Mr. Boulevard, apparently. Do you know
him? Apparently,
no.
Yeah.
Fred, no.
I believe so.
And they grafted that onto the seedling of the original Chemiocyperus piscifera.
Well, whatever you said.
Yeah. So that should be sprouting from the base or from low down on the trunk. Yeah. So that's what we would ask
The same thing happens with roses and sometimes with fruit trees. And it's hard to believe, but the part of the system that's a root may not even be the same kind of plant as the top.
That's
correct. Like lilacs and privet will be put together. So, and particularly with roses, if the top dies off, you get the rootstock coming up and you get these great massive canes but no flowers. So there's sometimes just two completely different plants there.
Yeah.
And again, if you're emailing one syllable words, really, I mean, very, very simple.
No. Let's test this.
There was a second question on that. I can tell. I remember what it is.
I'm already traumatized. Okay,
trying to take your job.
So he had the two plants. He didn't know what the other plant was. I believe.
All right. Well, if you're seeing more than one question here, I see a lot of.
Did not see that.
Maybe I could have made it up. Anyway, the other plant.
We're off to a flying start in 2018. Okay.
The other plant, I think, was a Hinoki cypress.
Could be.
Okay.
Did you see that big green one on the other side? Because he had a picture of it.
Yeah, I actually didn't see the picture.
You might actually have had that email. Maybe there's another email that came in. I'm not sure.
It was from Jim.
Well, I'll be darned.
Okay.
Well, let's just go to the phones and we'll call it a wash. 800-348-2551. Bob in Holland Patent. Bob, you're on.
Thank you for receiving my call. I appreciate this program very much.
Good.
My first is a comment. We have a clump birch 60 feet high, and the snow has bent it over, and two of them have come up about halfway to where they belong. It's not the first time, but, of course, the tree gets bigger each winter that this happens. And the third one is still some of the smaller branches are connected to the ground. I think as soon as the snow leaves, it will probably come up because there's no abrupt kinks in it. It's just a beautiful arch like the McDonald arches.
Nice.
But my question is, we have a quince bush which is grafted with several apple trees, different flavors of apples, five different ones, and the apple pies from it are absolutely delicious.
Terrific.
That variety of apples. But at any rate, what's happened this winter with the heavy snow, the tree is heavy on one side, and it's pushed that side over, and the roots on the other side have lifted from the ground. They're probably 2 feet out. Now, if those roots are kept moist yet, and we re-dig under it, and his old Governor Cuomo said about his father, push him up.
Oh, you remember that story.
And get those roots back in the ground and covered as long as they're moist. Will we save that quince bush tree?
You most likely will. Yes. I've had really good luck anchoring plants back up. You might need to put a stake or two temporarily to kind of hold that. And then once it kind of roots, leave it on for a handful of months and
we have some Norway spruce trees nearby that we can easily rope it to.
Yep, and I've had really good luck doing that with plants, especially early spring.
As soon as
that ground becomes workable. But you've got the right idea, and you should have good luck with that.
And Bob, 3 points awarded for the Mario Cuomo reference. Well done. Over to Mary in Del Mar. Mary, you're on.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm putting in a new path in my front yard this spring. And I'd like to put some plants along the sides of it, kind of to set it apart from the rest of the lawn. But I don't want anything really formal like a boxwood hedge. So I was calling to see if you all would have any recommendations about options.
Wow.
Well, you got a lot of.
I always see a small perennial border along a walkway. I'm not sure why. Maybe because you can throw the snow on the perennials in the winter because they're not there.
Salt won't hurt it if you have to use any.
I mean, what about Japanese knotweed? Very popular in Delmar. Very popular.
No, I wouldn't recommend that.
No, okay, don't do that.
No, no. You could also
right,
mix
I'll
in.
Avoid that.
Yep, you could also mix in some low, maybe woody plants too that are a little bit more resistant to getting crushed,
is it,
like alpine.
Is it sunny or shady? This the area.
Sort of partial sun.
Partial sun.
Okay.
Okay. Well, that limits you a little bit then.
Yeah. I mean, low woody plants that are fairly versatile. Again, why we keep saying low because we assume this is what we envision, that you wouldn't want anything too tall.
Yeah, so, I don't want.
So there are small spirea.
Spirea, big one.
You know, there are some small Wigelia now. They're getting tighter and a little more compact. Mm. You know, you could do things like low bush blueberry or some of the newer crosses, which are these tidy little 2x2 plants. They give you the fruit. They have really interesting foliage now these days.
And if you are thinking spirea that Greg had mentioned, one nice really low one that stays super compact with no pruning is called the alpine spirea, and that would take part sun, part shade. That one works well. I would also, from a design standpoint, have you considered a couple of elements. One of the things is that walkway. I don't know if it's like a center walkway that's leading you right to a door, or is it is it more perpendicular to where the front door would be, and is it kind of going along the side of the house? I didn't know.
The plan is to go from the front door, which is in the middle of the facade of the house, straight to the sidewalk.
Straight to the sidewalk. Yep. So the general rule with this is that you kind of like want to make sure that the eye, and it's kind of easy if you're centering it the way you're sort of saying with the sidewalk, but you want people to basically look at that house and know right where to go. So the landscape's goal is to kind of lead you to that front door. And my guess is that you probably have a mulch bed around the house foundation plantings. So you would want to think about how you might be able to tie that into the bed that you're going to put along the side of the walkway, maybe a curved bed that kind of curves in at the end, flares out or something.
I'd leave a little space for some annuals, too, maybe some begonias or impatiens.
Tuck those in every spring.
Yeah, because that gives you color all the time, and the perennials won't give you color the whole season.
That's right.
All right, Mary, we have to take a break here. It's The Gardening Show. Fred Breglia, Greg Ward, and Bob Graves here with us today to answer your questions. It's 800-348-2551. We'll be right back.
Support for Vox Pop on WAMC comes from Hadley Garden Center, Hadley, Massachusetts. Locally owned and operated for over 50 years, offering indoor and outdoor plants, gardening supplies, organic fertilizer, and advice. HadleyGardenCenter.com. The Hyde Collection in Glens Falls. This winter features an exhibition of the art of Alphonse Mucha, 75 works highlighting the sinuous lines and whiplash curves that came to define Art Nouveau. HydeCollection.org. The Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. HenyonBakery.com. And from Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York, specializing in distinctive eyewear, featuring new styles for 2018. Eye exams by appointment, 518-459-2638.
Welcome back to Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you, 800-348-2551, the number. And we have the dream team here of gardeners. It's always exciting to have them here. It's always, except in the dead of winter when we do that one show. this always is a good sign.
Sorry,
no.
I missed that one.
No, I'm sorry. The comma of my sentence was in the wrong spot. It's always a sign of spring when they're here, except for
that one. Okay,
that one in the winter. You just gotta let me finish, Bob.
Yeah, okay.
Just pull your jets, man. Hey, stuff going on over at Fatigan's.
Yeah, we got some seminars coming up. One's on perennials in April, dividing. We have a gardening lecture with Carrie Mendez in April 13th, hydrangeas on April 7th, and I'm doing one on critters.
Critters. What kind of critters?
How to control any kind of critters.
Yeah.
Little critters, big critters, critters.
Wild boars and stuff?
Well, no, we don't have wild boars.
Okay.
Here. Not right. yet.
Not yet.
So how do people find out more about that stuff?
Fadigans.com.
Okay.
The website.
And how about Greg Ward over at Ward's Nursery in Great Barrington?
Well, we're last few days of our March Madness extravaganza. If you're interested, stop by. It's a really fun and interesting time. We've forced a lot of woody plants in the garden center, so it's a pretty fun walkthrough, little botanical experience there inside, a little ahead of schedule. But, you know, in Great Barrington, the snow has mostly melted, and it's getting pretty open. So, you know, pansies in containers are something we're actually contemplating now. You know, the silver maples are actually in bloom. I'm not sure about at your house, Fred.
No, not at our house.
But
no,
we have,
but,
you know,
but they are in Albany.
Yeah, a few native trees one is actually in bloom now, and a couple are thinking about it and should, after Saturday or next week, be popping open.
Great. How about you? How about the Landis Arboretum, Fred?
Yeah, well, I would like to say that our calendar of events for 2018 is complete, and it's printed, and it's also up on our website, www.landisarboretum.org. We have an exciting year planned. Everything from all the concerts that we're planning to have, they're all picked, and there's all links to the performers.
Oh,
we have our plant sale. Of course, our signature sales are up on the calendar, as well as a bunch of educational programs, both from a horticultural standpoint, as well as the natural world around you, and all the star parties that we host out there, which is in conjunction with the Albany Area Astronomers. All those dates, and those star parties are all free, by the way, if you've never been to one. Incredible.
Yeah.
It's we have really, really dark skies, and we're close to Albany, so if you haven't been to one of them, definitely check it out. All the dates are on our website, landisarboretum.org.
Now, when you have the music, do you have rock and roll at all?
We actually have all genres kind of represented.
Huh.
We try to diversify, so yes, rock and roll, blues, country, bluegrass, classical.
Does the loud music offend the plants at all?
No. We find that they actually like it.
You
know, certain ones prefer the heavier stuff.
Yeah, I was gonna say,
certain,
they have
of
preferences.
Course,
sure, right.
You know, they have preferences. And the right. Classical appeals to, you know, certainly a wide variety of them as well.
Now, before we get to a few emails here, just a quick question. I don't want to take up the show with my own questions, but my wife bought corn seeds. I'm fearful. What do we do and when?
It's so fun.
Yeah?
You're
going to
love
not now.
No, not now? Don't throw them in now?
Wait. Definitely wait.
Till when?
You know, the first couple of weeks of May, at the earliest, you could take them and put them right in the ground.
Okay.
You want to soak them first, you know, so they swell up.
In water?
In water.
Okay.
Correct.
All right.
You need, you know, maybe 10 feet by 3 or 4 feet at the most, a little spot like that.
Okay.
It doesn't even have to be 10 feet, 6 by, and you want to make rows, at least 3 rows, whatever the long way is.
Okay.
And you
why at least 3?
Well,
two is not
because they're wind pollinated.
Oh.
So you want to keep them so they're all the pollen's kind of getting knocked around in between the corn stalks.
So early May we start this procedure.
Or you can actually do the same thing and put them in a little pot, like tiny little seed tray, and start them all first and do that. Right there by the on the deck, or
but
on the
still
patio,
do that in May. Don't do it now.
Do you think you gain much with corn by starting it early?
You don't gain a lot by getting them started, but you know what? When you're doing a little batch like that, just
make
a kind
sure
of
you get germination.
You get complete germination. So then you might have some skips, and then the other thing is those darn crows.
Oh,
will
the
come by
themselves.
And just as the thing has sprouted,
we'll
pull it up, not for the sprout, but for the seed that's left.
So what do I do?
So you just, as Greg had said, if you started them, you're not going to have that problem.
Okay.
Because you're
going to
plant them later,
okay.
And that will
seed
be over.
But not too early.
I mean, otherwise we'll just position a child out in the garden.
Well, right? You have plenty of those.
On shifts.
With plenty of those.
You can spare one, I'm sure.
All right, let's go to a couple of emails and then back to the phones. This one is from Ruth. In the most recent heavy, wet snow storms, a spruce tree has bent over and has not come back up. The trunk splits into two at about 3 feet up from the ground. I believe this has made the tree weaker. I'd like to get it upright again. Could you suggest a method, or would it be better to hire an arborist? That is from Ruth.
Did she say how big the spruce was?
She did not.
No. So that is certainly a question, because if it's a smaller tree, which the fact that she even thinks that she could do this herself makes me think it's not too big.
Yeah.
In which case, they really do stake pretty well. You can bend them, tie them,
okay,
and just hold them for a while, and they will take their form back in most cases. But if it is a large tree, then you are going to want to get a professional in there because they're going to need some pretty heavy equipment.
Yeah,
and the fact that she did recognize that the trunk split into two, that is a structural defect, and that is certainly that doesn't mean take it down, but that's going to make that problem a little bit worse and more prone to bending and more prone to future breaks too.
All right. This one is from Aaron in Albany. Hey there, what should I do about any dead-looking branches that aren't producing any buds for flowers on my rhododendrons? Should I simply cut the dead-looking branches off? Is there a best time of year to do this? And that is from Aaron.
Yeah, we were sort of talking about winter damage, and on rhododendron you may have some dry branches, may have even been from last summer, and it's showing up now. But if you know the branch is dead, as often said on the show, you would not just nip whatever's dead off, but you would follow that branch back to the next live branch and cut there, leaving just a little bit of a nub.
Yep. If you're unsure, it isn't going to hurt you to wait.
Okay.
See.
Yep. Or you could also scratch the bark on that branch and make sure you see brown, not green.
Right.
Because sometimes rhodies can look really bad, especially this year with this weird weather, and they might appear like they're mostly dead with some really browned up leaves, but they will come back.
Or eaten, as I had mentioned earlier. It's possible that all the foliage was eaten and it looks dead,
but it's not.
And they'll sprout right out.
When in doubt, scratch it, or you can always wait.
Yeah.
It's always my motto. This is from Subash in Pittsfield. What is the best time to fertilize flowering shrubs such as a beauty bush, quince, spirea, wigelia, and Korean spice bush?
Spring is awesome.
Spring.
Prior to the buds actually opening, their roots are gathering maximum material. So if you get that down prior to the main flush of spring growth, you're going to get optimal uptake.
Yeah.
It is the best overall time. There are other times, in case you missed that, midsummer and also even fall later.
Yep.
But
good.
Can't beat that early springtime.
All right, back to the phones we go. And Mike in Saratoga Lake. Mike, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Love the show.
Thanks
for doing this, guys. I actually had a quick question about early season lawn care. Most of the snow is off my lawn, but there's still some on there. I was just wondering, some of my lawn is green and some is brown. Should I be thatching out all the brown stuff because it's dead to make room for new growth, or should I just kind of leave it and see if it turns green?
Well, you can start to fertilize after April 1st in New York State, and obviously that's next week.
Is that a law?
Yeah, it's New York State law.
Oh, I didn't know
fertilize
that.
In the wintertime. We don't really know what's going on there. You might have had some snow mold that might have killed that grass. You might have had some chinch bug damage from last year. The question is whether, if it looked brown last year, it's different than if it looked good and going into the winter. But my guess is, you're going to want to chew that up with a rake or a thatcher and reseed it.
But because there's still snow in the yard, you may want to just wait a little longer.
Wait a little bit.
Just to let the ground drain completely and thaw completely. If you step out there and it's firm and dry, it's not spongy or doesn't give much at all, you're probably ready to rake. But if it seems a little soft,
what kind of soil you got,
it's better to just wait another week. It could be as simple as the green spot has been getting more sun and melted off sooner, and the brown spot's just opened up.
Yep. Okay.
Thanks, Mike. We appreciate it. Now, why that law? Why do you have to wait to fertilize?
It's pollution, runoff.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so the melting snow will take it?
Well, the material isn't utilized over the course of the winter because of the temperature.
Interesting. And if the ground is frozen.
It's not going in.
I don't think that's ever come up on this program. It's the first time I've ever heard that.
It's been for, a number of years in New York State.
All right, let's go to Jim in North Pownell, Vermont. Jim, you're on.
Hi.
Hello.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got an invasive crop of Japanese knotweed that I have been fighting for years, and I've read up on it, and they say that the best way to deal with it is to keep mowing it and mowing it, but unfortunately it's in a location where I can't get in with a mower. Is there any other thing that I can do to get rid of this stuff?
so if you can't mow it with a push or driving mower, can you weed whack it? That would be the next alternative. Because what all the articles say is that cutting it back consistently and not not giving it a chance to really grow back is very effective. That it works quite well.
And there's a timing for that, right? Fred,
well,
we've talked about this.
There certainly is with woody plants. With Japanese knotweed, it's kind of consistent. If you are trying to get rid of anything that's a woody plant, you wait till it basically leaves out. It uses all that stored energy. It doesn't have much stored energy in the roots. And then you whack it back,
yeah.
And then there's nothing for to make more energy. No
right.
Photosynthesis can happen on no branches, so leaves. So in essence, you are able to really weaken that plant. Japanese knotweed, and that still certainly works. So of course, but you don't really you don't get the same benefit out of that because it's not a true woody plant. It's more of a herbaceous.
Just keep cutting.
And you really want to keep cutting it. And when they say cut it, they do mean cut it low.
Yep.
If you cut it and leave enough leaves there where it can still photosynthesize, right. It's
basically
not
trying to starve that root system.
Yeah.
So you got to keep it pushing up new growth. And it'll take 5 years.
It will. And I've had good luck cutting it.
We've been fighting them for 15 years at my house.
So yeah. The other
cut it lower.
Yeah.
Cut it even lower.
Possibility would be to cover.
Oh, when I do cut it, I cut it right back to the ground. But
it may be almost weekly with something like this.
It might be because if you start to see new leaves after you've cut it, a week or two later, those new leaves are now making energy for that root. So it's going to be constant until you weaken it.
Yeah.
You don't want to give it 4 weeks in between cutting.
Yeah, that gives it a lot of energy, and this could be a sort of a perpetual problem. So if you cut it and then very aggressively until you start to really weaken it, and then go even more aggressive.
Well, Jim, thank you for the call. It is the gardening show on WAMC. Greg?
Well, just covering it heavy black plastic again, that will take more than a season as well, but that is another alternative if it's a small enough area.
We are joined today by Greg Ward, Fred Breglia, and Bob Graves. It's The Gardening Show. First one of the spring, and over to Eliana in Boston. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. I'm calling because I just recently purchased a home which sits on a third of an acre. It sits about a mile away from a quarry, so all of the ground is incredibly rocky in the back, but it's beautiful. It's got a gorgeous forest in it as well. But the grounds itself, the trees really have not taken root in some places, so I need to go through and clean them out. What I'm wondering is if what plants I could possibly put in there that would take hold given the environment that it's in, really kind of thinking towards a kind of an homestead type feel.
Rocky soil is not necessarily bad for plants to grow in, but I've been in situations, and particularly around here in Rensselaer County, where we were on bedrock, we literally rented an electric jackhammer to produce a hole,
really,
just to try to get the plant in the ground, because a lot of times plants will grow in rocky stuff because it's well drained. You may need to give it some extra help. But the hard part is just getting it in the ground.
It's about whether you're trying to plant on ledge. 2 feet of soil is sort of a nice minimum measurement to sort of, try to create or have. And so it sounds like what you need to do is start looking around in your yard and finding the pockets. Where is it that the ledge is not and the soil has filled in?
Yep.
Then you can plant pretty much what you want in those areas.
Yeah, and I always tell people when you have harsh sites, it's not so. If you fight Mother Nature, you almost always lose.
Yeah.
So you always want to plant what's going to naturally grow there or work there. And one way, if you're not an expert, is to look around what's growing, what's big. Anything that's large is or mature in that area is certainly going to work with the pH that's in your site, which you certainly could do before you start planting a lot, too. You could have your soil tested. But if you see plants that are growing there, you know that type of plant. And then you just got to figure out, okay, well, these are growing there, but they're kind of a weed species, so you don't really want that. But these are growing there, and they're kind of like a desirable. And you can start picking and choosing as to what will work. And there's going to be a lot of plants, just like what Bob said, that like rocky sites. So it's not like, I got a rocky site, it's bad. It's just a matter of really matching that. just match that site with the plants that like it. There are plants that like rocky soil. If you take a plant that really likes a rocky, heavy soil and you put that in a really rich bottom soil, it's not going to do too well.
Okay.
So, you can actually work to an advantage for a lot of plants.
You want to follow up?
Yeah. Would you have any other plant recommendations, things like rhododendrons or anything that would fit in a forest bed like that where it's not going to get a ton of sunlight in that type of soil?
You're in Boston area?
I am.
So you get to plant a lot more things than we get to plant out here in the hills of the West. So generally the pH out there is fairly acidic. Pretty much most of Massachusetts is, except for this western hilly spot. We have variable pHs. So rhododendron could be a very good choice. They do tolerate low light. They still would require some light. It would be best if they had some direct sunlight for part of the day.
Mountain laurel's another one a lot along the turnpike as you go into
Boston. Mountain laurels?
Mountain laurel, in a shady area.
So if you're looking at for evergreens, rhododendron, mountain laurel, that other plant called Andromeda or Pieris works really well.
Hemlock might be an option.
Yeah, and that also depends a little bit on what kind of wind you've got in there, too. If you got a lot of wind in there, then some of those like rhododendrons are going to dry themselves out pretty good quickly through the winter months. Yeah. So that plays a role, too. I would recommend possibly a soil test. You know, that way you know exactly what you've got. I know in New York you can take your soil to a local cooperative extension, and then what I typically have always done is actually have them send it out to Cornell University, and they'll give you a complete fertility test. You can name a whole bunch of different plants that you're hoping to grow, and they'll tell you how that correlates to that.
Yeah, UMass will do it for them.
And then UMass, Bob says, will do it as well.
Yep. There's probably some very good garden centers out there or some landscape contractors that would help you maybe with that layout.
Well, thank you for the call, and we love hearing from Boston. That's very nice. Let's go to Bob in Saratoga Springs. Bob.
Hello. How are you?
Good.
Hey, thank you. So we bought a farm last year. We're thinking about putting in a vegetable garden. And the issue is there's a herd of deer right in the back pasture. They're almost tame. They come right up to the barn. So I don't think they would fear us being in the house. And the question is, what kind of fencing should I put in? We also have critters that bore underneath fences.
Yeah.
So that's another issue. And then the second part of the question is, I think it's partly going to be planted on a leaching field. Is that a problem?
You would definitely want to avoid the leaching field.
Yeah.
Because
a lot of reasons.
The possible contamination of whatever is leaching. So I would not plant the garden in the leaching field.
Yeah,
not for edibles.
You've got heavy metals issues there, and you're also concerned, you know, you get plants with any kind of a root system, depending upon how shallow your distribution pipes are, you can start to clog things up. But you're going to want at least a 7-foot tall fence. And maybe you want to drop it 2 or 3 feet into the ground with an additional piece. And sometimes you even electrify these things and to discourage critters. But if it's not 7 feet tall, they'll go right over it.
Yeah, and one product that I know we've used at the Arboretum, actually if you go online, you could find this type of thing. It's you can Google certainly deer fencing. The one that we've used is called Benner's Deer Fencing. And it's really, really, it's black. It's almost invisible. It has been in place I've been there 20 years. It was there before I was. It never photodegrades.
Huh.
It's really, really easy to install. All you need is some good posts.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be expensive.
Very light.
It's tall.
It's definitely 7 feet. Yeah. It meets Bob's height requirements for deer proofing. And it can also be installed very easily. You just dig down a foot so that it actually goes under the ground a little bit too. Most critters that are going to try to tunnel under will never go more than 6 to 8 inches because they try to dig, they find any kind of fencing, they quit. They don't know that, you know, if you got 2 feet, you'd be able to get under. So 12 inches is plenty.
The only thing I would add is that piece that you put in the ground, you may want to have that be metal.
That needs to be metal.
And of a small opening or diameter opening to, because you want to be able to keep out the woodchucks. Those are the real culprits. Mm-hmm. But you also want to be able to keep out very small or very young rabbits. They're pretty good at slipping through the typical like 2x3 page wire hole. So you'd want it to be smaller than that. And a foot is probably plenty, even 6 inches, and then bent outward facing away from the garden. Because they'll start digging a few inches out and hit that and stop.
Okay, let's take a break here. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. The Gardening Show moving quickly today. Bob, Fred, and Greg are here to take your calls. We'll be back.
Support for WAMC comes from Colby Attorney's Service, document filing, document and information retrieval, and other services, including legal publishing and corporate record searches. ColbyService.com. Grapes and Grains Wine and Spirits, East Greenbush, New York. Specializing in wine and craft spirits for more than 15 years. Stocking single malts, bourbons, tequilas, and gins. GrapesandGrainsWine.com. And from Watercolors by Edith, Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors, specializing in portrait paintings of people and pets from photographs. Edith-Hunsberger.artistwebsites.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. The Gardening Show with Fred Breglia, Bob Graves, and Greg Ward all here in the studio to answer your questions. A few emails here. This one is from Karen in Woodstock. If you have a well-established garden with shrubs, small trees, and perennials, how can you give the soil a good shot of new life, fertilizing it and perking it up without disturbing the roots, etc.?
Well, that's an easy one. You just broadcast. I recommend an organic fertilizer, and you just broadcast that down in spring prior to growth. And it's mobile, so when you put it on the surface, it goes down into the soil profile.
Fertilizing doesn't have to be hard.
No.
You get some granular organic, you throw it around. You don't have to mix any liquid. You don't have to pound anything in the ground. And there's no research that indicates that any one of those is any better than any other.
Nope. Right. And it actually shows you just topically apply it, and it goes down into the profile.
And so if you have a mulched area that you're fertilizing on top of, then take your rake lightly and just move the mulch around, not so deep that you're bothering any roots,
yeah.
So that the fertilizer drops in, so it's not, you no longer see it.
And then you kind of rake the mulch back over, and that works really well.
This one is from Jerry in Del Mar. Asian jumping worm. Would you please speak about this worm and its issues with our gardens, and what should we be aware of buying soil, mulch, and plants?
I think, well, the first part I can answer, the first part is about the worm. So there's this earthworm that is sort of moving in. I haven't really had to talk about it yet, so it's sort of still new for us.
Yeah.
But in terms of mulch or plants, in general, plants are using a processed mix. You shouldn't get any Asian jumping worms in that soil. If you're buying compost from a bulk source, you know, there's the possibility that it has not cooked enough and that it's contaminated, so you might want to
consider
that.
Most compost has been
composted
for a while, which produces a pretty high temperature, so you don't get a lot of insect activity or worm
activity.
The
big problem with them, though, is that they break down organic matter rapidly.
Yeah.
So we like earthworms, and they break down organic matter, and that's a good thing. They help to aerate the soil. But these guys are breaking it down so fast, they're not leaving it. There's not much left for anything else. So. I think it's going to be another problem we're going to see and hear more of.
Something we'll work on for the next
one. All right. That's homework. Good. This one is from Gardner. Oh, how appropriate. In Rhinebeck, any ideas on how to safely remove a yellow jacket nest from a perennial garden? The nest is beneath the surface, and the ground is rich with earthworms, which so haven't used pesticides. I'm not sure we're missing a word there. We tried inserting a garden hose into the opening of the nest and flooding them out, but it didn't work.
You shouldn't have those guys come back in the same area twice.
Boy, I dug up a ground bee nest like that once, and the nest was actually like 20 feet away from where the hole was.
A lot of times it is.
It's really hard to know where they are.
I thought the ground bees didn't sting.
Yellow jackets are
in the ground?
They are. They nest in the ground.
They're very aggressive.
And they're
yellow jackets.
They are a ground bee. There are other ground bees, though, like you say, that are not that aggressive.
No, they just kind of hang around and then they're gone.
They're kind of scary. I hope that's not a yellow jacket. But it's.
You might try a diatomaceous earth spread around the opening where they would carry that in. That's an organic material that slices up the body of the insect.
Right. So if you're looking for organic methods, you would want to sort of blow that in, though.
They'd have to get it on their bodies.
And then the first thing is, of course, as Fred said, it's now spring. Obviously, those yellow jackets are not active now. Digging up whatever is there now and seeing if you can find the nest will certainly remove it without any issues. And then next year, if you have that same problem, waiting until cold fall morning, you know, freezing morning when they're unable to move around and doing the same thing.
All right, this one is from Daniel, and then we'll get back to the phones. Just a question from a grower here in central New York, having lots of problems from both moles and voles with early hoop house plantings, lots of tunneling both mole width and vole width with piles of dirt, in addition to the voles eating and moving seedlings. Have tried many repellents and traps to little avail. Any good ideas from keeping them for keeping them away until they have green things to eat elsewhere outside after the snow melts? How do they dig? And that's from Daniel.
Yeah, they're, oh, how they're deep well
do they,
equipped.
How deep do they dig?
So the culprits that he that are really bothering the garden would be the vole or the plants, voles, and maybe there's some field mice in there as well. And setting little mouse traps, especially if he has these hoops that he can set all these traps in and nothing else is getting in there, just load it with mouse traps. You know,
they're cheap.
Yep, they're cheap. Baiting it is
the
question.
They do work really, really well.
But, I've always used peanut butter.
Yeah.
I've had good luck with that, too, and sometimes I'll take it a step further with voles and sometimes just get different kinds of seeds. So you can actually, like, dip the peanut butter into, like, a seed mix.
You really got to start in the fall. You really want to start in October because that's when they're most active looking for food and they're really easy to catch.
Yep. And the moles are not the ones eating plants.
Moles are not your problem.
Moles eat grubs.
Okay.
So they're not.
So they're a good thing.
They're digging up the soil.
I think so. I mean, Bob would tell you that they make a mess on the lawn, but... They're not eating roots of perennials or woody plants.
Okay,
shouldn't be bothering anything in the garden. A rake, just raking out wherever the damage is, should be enough.
Yep, pretty easy.
Fair enough. Let's go back to the phones. And Evelyn in Great Barrington is on. Evelyn.
Yes. Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. I love the show.
Thank you.
So I have about 5 years ago I bought this house. I planted. Flowering shrubs, so I have hydrangea, viburnum, weigela, I never know how to pronounce this, spirea, and others, a couple unidentified ones, but they're, you know, they're just sort of separated, right? So what I want to do at this next phase is to unify them and create sort of a visual, you know, unity amongst them because it's along my front, along the curb.
Yep.
I do have a split rail fence. So, you know, the plan was to sort of remove the sod, mulch it. And I'm wondering, do I just sort of leave room for annuals? Do I plant some perennials there? Do I go for ground cover?
You know, one thing that we learned back in design classes that I've taught, you know, and took many, many, many years ago. One thing they always say is that if you want to create unity, you do that through repetition. So you want to repeat things that you've got to help tie this together. And it doesn't always have to be the exact same plant. For example, I've got a couple of red flowering shrubs. You might want to put a couple of other red flowering shrubs elsewhere in the landscape so that it's kind of evenly somewhat distributed. Asymmetrical always works better, planting in odd numbers. And tying it together with a line, what we call rhythm of line, it really helps to create a flow.
You don't want your eye to dance when it comes up to something like that. You like to have something that's going to focus it in one spot and then maybe focus it in another.
Yep.
Very rarely do we plant a whole bunch of different things in one spot because your eye is very confused as to where it should go.
And so planting more of what you already have is one way to tie it together. If you have one spirea and you put two more so that it's a group of odd numbers, say three, that creates a larger area that will close in those spaces. And so that's certainly something you can consider.
All right. Well, Evelyn, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go over to, let's go to line three and Ryan in Warwick. Ryan, you're on.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So my wife and I, we do a lot of canning. We do the wild raspberries that grow on the road, and we do all the mulberries and everything. We have a space in our yard that we'd like to make some berry bushes. We've tried blueberries in the past, but they just don't seem to take hold. Is there something you could recommend, just like a great, easy berry bush to grow?
Boy, my favorite's the red raspberry. I got so many raspberries, I can't keep up with them. The blueberries, you have to have the right soil conditions, but the birds, you got to fight the birds. The rabbits will eat them in the wintertime. Blueberries are great, but the raspberries, nobody touches them. You just have to trim them every year.
And they do make there's a nice, really nice yellow one that's out too.
There's some yellow ones
that are very prolific too. Very prolific.
So choosing raspberries is kind of interesting. There are raspberries that fruit twice or bloom twice bearing, and that would be the best choice. And there are red and yellow selections.
Yeah, mine I get berries almost till Thanksgiving.
Okay, yeah, great. We see a lot of them, you know, the ones that grow wild on the side of the road.
And some of them were actually developed in this area. I mean, one of the oldest varieties is Latham, which is named after Latham, New York.
Was it done at Fatigan's?
No, not by us.
No?
Yeah, also blackberries, too. They would be another. They go right along with the raspberries, but that's a completely different taste. So if you wanted to mix it up, blackberry jam, raspberry jam, two completely different jams.
Are blackberries hard to grow? Or do they grow in
They're like the raspberry. It's very much
sometimes
tough
a
plant.
Bigger plant.
Yeah, little rangier plant. Yeah.
They get larger.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Hal in Fishkill. Hal, you're on.
Hi. So I have a house, and foundation plantings were put in about 40 years ago. They were done commercially. And about a year ago, I noticed one of the rhododendrons just died, out and died. And in this fall, I put in a new one in the same place. And during the winter, that one has died. I actually planted it in October, and by midwinter, like more or less January, the thing was browning up and leaves were curling. That rhododendron is adjacent to a burning bush. Around the burning bush in a semicircle are Cantaniaster plants, low-growing, so we keep the burning bush kind of trimmed. These Cantaniaisters grow around it, and to one side of it was the rhododendron. I now notice that the Cantaniaisters are dying. Hmm. And so my question is, do you guys know if burning bush roots perhaps can work their way over 40 years and kind of plants?
What actually comes to mind first is, in terms of the second rhododendron failing, it was just that rhododendron.
I think it's unrelated.
Yeah, desiccation, okay. It's a new plant, and things happen, and October is not a terrible time to plant rhododendron, but not probably the ideal time. Spring, you know, would be better. You have a longer season. You're watching it. You're watering it more frequently. So considering that over again would certainly be something I would recommend. But why did the first rhododendron die when you took it up, or whoever did? They may or may not have noticed, and it's probably too late now. But if then, again, the Cantaniaster are starting to fail, as you lift them, as you pull them out, look for roots that have been eaten.
Yeah.
So what I'm leading to is that vole word again, where voles have moved in and they're now feeding on the roots of the plants during the winter, and they may have done that to the rhododendron, or it may have been unrelated.
The other thing I'd be looking at with that rhododendron, with one that age, is rhododendron borer. You get a borer in the stems, and you'll see holes and trails and tunnels on the lower 2 feet of the branches. That's a possibility. If the moisture has changed, fungal diseases can affect rhododendrons if it's gotten wetter. And the other thing with Cantaniaster is the rabbits love them.
Yes, they do. And the burning bush of all these plants we're talking about, even though it isn't, unfortunately, an invasive plant in New York State, so something that we don't recommend planting anymore in terms of the burning bush, it's invasive because it's very tough.
Yeah.
And of those three plants you mentioned, of course, the burning bush would be the toughest one, the least susceptible to even if it was eaten on the roots, it would be more apt to live.
Okay.
So, but I think giving that rhododendron, since the other one that was there a while, would certainly be a viable option. Just make sure you're planting it correctly and keeping it watered during drought times. And
all right, let's go over to
work for you,
Susan in Woodstock. Susan, you're on.
Hi, I have a Japanese andromeda that I put in the ground late summer. And the tips of it are burning or burnt from the winter. The plant itself was about 18 inches tall, and the tips are of maybe 4 inches are brown right now.
Yeah.
Do I just trim them back? What would I do?
You're going to want to trim any brown off, but maybe waiting another 3 or 4 weeks until you're sure the ground underneath is thawed, the air temperatures have been consistently above freezing for a while, because the plant hasn't finished waking up, and you're not sure where to prune it yet.
But we're going to see a lot of that type of thing on those types of plants this winter.
And a lot of times the branch itself may not even be dead, just the leaves might be. And if it's not dead, you're going to actually get regrowth
just
out of that. So, you know, I'm going to put this out to the greater masses. When in doubt, just wait. Just wait this year. Wait a little longer before you start taking dead branches off. Let's see what's actually going to flee. The great thing about dead wood is you can prune it anytime. Yep. So let it leaf out, then prune.
All right, Jonathan in Chicopee. Jonathan, you're on.
Yes. I had a soil test done by UMass, and they said I'm high in just about everything, and they had a exclamation point about phosphorus. So I'm just wondering, other than just not, I've been composting for maybe 25 years. And I didn't notice anything wrong with composting, but I guess you can't do it too much. And I'm now wondering what might be the best course to bring in my gardens back to where they can be.
Was your pH okay?
No, the pH is too high also.
Yeah, that you bring down with sulfur. That's the easiest way to do that.
And your nitrogen?
Sulfur, okay. Nitrogen is needed.
Yeah, and sulfur goes a long ways. So, in other words, a little bit, I should say, goes a long ways. So be careful with sulfur. It has a powerful buffering action. But that is going to be the element to lower pH.
All right, Jonathan, and, thank you. Go ahead.
Yeah,
right.
And then just the on the nitrogen, it's hard to find complete for, or fertilizers that aren't complete, that don't already have phosphorus and potassium in them. But they do exist, and so looking for a
actually,
simple
even your
nitrogen
lawn fertilizers
source.
Now have no phosphorus and are high nitrogen. So not that you'd normally use a lawn fertilizer in that setting, but that might make sense.
And there are several organic selections now, so an organic lawn fertilizer could be the best thing.
Okay. Yeah, the other thing about phosphorus is that it doesn't leach out of the profile of that soil too easy. Nitrogen goes right through the profile, but if you have a buildup of phosphorus, it takes a little longer for that to actually just leach down through the soil profile. Nitrogen goes real quick.
Very interesting. All right, Fred Breglia, how do people find out more about Landis Arboretum?
LandisArboretum.org.
And Greg Ward, Ward's Nursery.
WardsNursery.com.
And how about you, Bob Graves, Fadigan's?
Fadigan's.com.
Well, this was a successful program.
Very good.
Not that I'm surprised.
And your pronunciations have been good.
Yes.
Especially the scientific stuff.
Well, thank you very much. And support comes from Kirshner Concerts and Step Up Presents Celtic Thunder X at the Palace Theater September 23rd. Tickets on sale at Ticketmaster.com. At Marshall and Sterling, insurance for business, home, auto, bonds, group benefits, and financial planning for over 150 years. Our people are your best insurance. Offices in New Windsor, Middletown, Kingston, and Monticello, MarshallSterling.com. Thanks again to Greg Ward, Fred Breglia, and Bob Graves for being here. Thank you for listening. Some terrific calls and great emails today. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Deb Malik answered the calls. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on Food Friday, Deanna Fox is back in the studio with her favorite upstate New York foods. Right now, stand by for news.